President Biden's administration seems to have been given a blank check in regards to aid packages to Ukraine. Ironically, America's borrowing money from China all to stay afloat. To make matters worse, President Biden is planning on revoking Trump-era tariffs and sanctions on other countries to try and combat inflation. But doesn't lowering the price of imported products make domestic products less competitive? When did it become wrong for a country to strive for the best products with the best revenue? I'm Skynell Hughes, and on this second part of our series on nationalism, we're going to focus on economic nationalism and why countries are now making decisions which are not in the best interest of their own economy. Since when did economic nationalism become bad for business? Biden administration continues to write billion-dollar checks to Ukraine, topping almost $50 billion at this stage, a country not even a part of NATO. Meanwhile, Americans are dealing with record prices at the pump and a food shortage. And while it is almost trendy to talk about hating America, you see little blue and yellow flags on screen names across the Twitterverse. After months, mothers are still struggling to feed their babies in America. The U.S.-Mexico border is open, and pallets of baby formula are being shipped to those entering the country illegally. I understand it's cruel to let a child starve simply because they were brought here by their parents. But arguments are being made saying people come here for a better life. However, is this a sign that America should keep borders closed, focus on the American citizen who's already suffering? If America keeps allowing everyone to come in, are we going to end up as poor and food insecure as the nations they left? To discuss America's obsession to save everyone is actually annihilating it, we bring in David Towle, the founder of ProChain Capital. Thank you so much for joining me, David.
Thank you, Scotty.
Okay, looking at the present state, in the past, we've been able to save the world at times. We've been strong enough, but at this exact moment in history, is America wearing herself thin by trying to save the world? Should we be putting ourselves first? And would a little bit of nationalism actually save our economy?
You hit it right on the head. We seem to have an obsession with helping out every impoverished, destitute, under fire country, person, group of people, community in the world. And we tend to go ahead and ignore our own. And really, the charity has to start at home. If this economy is heading into or already in a recession, families are struggling with basic necessities by reason of inflation or by reason of shortages of certain products, the administration has an obligation to immediately harness the entire power of the government in order to solve those problems first before we go ahead and worry about the destitute and the poor and the challenged all around the world.
Now, is this motivated by just being a good heart and feeling bad for those that are in less circumstances? Or is this more about a power struggle that the United States assumes if we give you aid, that means that we own you or that you have some sort of allegiance to us? Does it even matter?
I don't think it matters. I actually don't think it stems from there, although that would be a great bonus if we were to get that. But we certainly don't get that. We hand out dollars without even expecting the leaders of those countries to show up to, you know, meetings that we go ahead and orchestrate, right? We had the meeting of the Americas a couple of weeks ago, and the Mexican president decided not to come. But yet, look how much prosperity we provide to the Mexican government. So clearly, we're not getting our fair share of what we're owed, so to say. But beyond that, I think it's all about policy. You've got folks on the very far left inside of the Congress that are championing the rights of people all around the world while they ignore the constituents in their own voting district. And that policy is bad policy, not only long-term, but even short-term for the United States. We are undercutting our own citizens in order to go ahead and arguably in some situations who we're helping abroad are not necessarily the good guys. Sometimes we're helping the, you know, could be bad guys or, you know, it's gray. It's not clearly black and white. And but nevertheless, folks at home are hurting and it's unfair to them. And it's inappropriate for the government not to focus on them first.
And David, I have to be honest with you, that's why I continue to scratch my head, because these people continue to be put back in office when you look at the absolute devastation that their own communities are suffering. Doesn't matter. People still vote to put them back in. The real catch in all this is America is actually borrowing money from China, all to send aid to Ukraine and kind of basically fund this proxy war that is really making other countries like Russia obviously angry, even more angry at the U.S. We cannot keep printing money, which is what we've done, that is not even our own. What does happen to the American economy if China comes to collect the debt?
It's over. if they come to collect the debt, if they stop buying the debt, it's over. They are the biggest lender to the United States. We know that. We've known that for some time. There are dynamics far beyond just that straight computation to getting to the conclusion that China will always be a lender to the United States, thankfully, because we are the reserve currency of the world, and people do want to own our debt. It is the most stable debt there is out there. However, to your point, Scotty, if at some point in time we've undermined our economy so much by doing the wrong things with the money that we've got, and there is instability around the question of, are we the most stable economy in the world? Are we the strongest? And are we the reserve currency in the world? Well, then yes, that day of reckoning will come. And that's a very scary day, not only for China / the United States, but it'll automatically go ahead and trickle down into our pockets. I mean, we will have an unstable currency. We take for granted that our dollar is incredibly strong, and tomorrow morning when I wake up, the $100 that's in my pocket is going to have about the same amount of buying power as it did today. In a lot of countries in the world, that stability is not there, and we take it for granted. And to the extent that our largest lender at some point starts to question that, well, then all bets are off, and who knows what happens next.
So do we really exist on a level playing field in questioning anything China does if they own our debt? And you mentioned the reserve currency. Are you still very confident, considering the present situation of economics here in the U.S., that the dollar is going to remain the reserve currency for the world into the near future?
I'm pretty confident for my lifetime. I don't know about my children's lifetime. There are a lot of dynamics that go into answering that question, and a lot of prophetic, you know, future telling about the change in power that will go on in the world, you know, over the next decades to find out. But if the United States plays its cards right, it's in the best position to remain the world's reserve currency.
Well, and it's going to be interesting because at the same time, America is very divided. China seems like they're very politically, very nationalist, and they support their people economically in a nationalist sense, putting focus on increasing wages, jobs, economic output of their own. At the same time, it is heavily involved in the global economy and one of the key players in it. So it seems to be able to juggle nationalism and globalism and can do well in both spheres. Why is it that the United States doesn't seem to be able to do this? And why don't we seem to be able to support this healthy sense of national identity while also being the leaders in a global economy? What element of China having our debt plays in that?
Okay, so first of all, we have a lot of freedom in this country. We give people freedom not only of, you know, policy and political choices, but also when it comes to capitalism. We provide folks with the freedom to go out and earn whatever it is that they can achieve. And it's an incredible asset to this country. China does not have that in a lot of different ways. They have a leader now that is going to be there forever, almost life term. And then they have an economy that is very much controlled, almost down to the last yuan spent, right? Because they have digital yuan in that country where the government can go ahead and see into every single person's spending habits down to the, you know, the last yuan, you know, exactly how much and where they're directing their spending and investments and so forth. So there isn't that much by way of choices relative to the United States in China. That said, you know, those are two very different systems that are taking two very different approaches on the long-term gamble on which is going to go ahead and survive. Thankfully, our republic has survived these many years, and I think it's strong and, you know, continues to have strength. On the other hand, you know, the Chinese economy has largely been the beneficiary of coming into a more consumption economy over the last couple of decades, and so that's why they've seen incredible growth. Now that that consumption wave is over, the question is whether China is going to be able to keep up their growth rate, or at least, you know, bring it back, but still have it as at a relatively high level. Right. And that question, you know, remains outstanding in terms of, you know, how can China navigate their own quote unquote soft landing that they're supposed to have from their growth rate.
Well, and I agree that we are talking about apples and oranges of economies, but unfortunately, I do see America more changing in the way it's handling, actually looking more into a government-controlled economy than necessarily an independent capitalist as time goes on. A lot of it is a product of the pandemic that we just lived through. Before I let you go, I want to talk about BRICS. And we think the international bloc, and we immediately think about globalism in regards. But isn't BRICS, the way it's set up, really more a league, if you will, of like-minded countries who want to trade with one another, engage in the global economy, but at the same time, kind of have a secure understanding of their national identities and their national interests? Is the BRICS model not only a rival to the West, but a rival for the globalist agenda of the West, more importantly?
That's an excellent philosophical point on how you go ahead and set up. One way of saying it is understandings, and the other way of saying it is cartels. So you've got other cartels like OPEC, and you've got cartels like NATO, and then you've got the BRICS. You know, everyone's got a different makeup in terms of, you know, is this just an economic relationship? Is this a political relationship? Is this a policy relationship also? And they kind of all bleed into one another. You know, I think certainly all of these things, all of these different structures sound incredibly good on paper, right? They're set up very idealistically. And those lines, people try to draw them, you know, very definitively when setting up, you know, those communities of countries. But then difficult issues come down the pipe, and then you start to see disagreements and then cracks. So, yeah, certainly, if you're able to go ahead and simply leave the relationship to economic and then not have anything to do with politics or policy inside of each country, or say it another way, you have, you know, very strong feeling of nationalism for each country in and of on its own, that seems to work out very well. In the United States, however, you know, we for better or worse, and I think on the whole for better, you know, we take our position in the world as the champions of democracy, you know, very seriously. And we're the champions of lots of other policies as well, you know, at times. And we try to go ahead and align ourselves with countries that are similarly mindful of those things. And in addition, we try to incentivize countries to go along with us. And maybe that's wrong. Maybe we're trying to buy some support. But that's what we do here in the United States. I don't expect that to change much over time. It's really a principle upon which we're built.
Well, David Tao, founder of ProChain Capital, thank you so much for sharing us your insight. We'll chat again.
Thank you.
Now, as inflation rises, one major party suffering the most in America are farmers. We will talk to one when we come back after the break with more 360 View.
Frank, I'm originally from Philadelphia. Got in the movement in 88. I was 13 going on 14.
We were violent towards those people because we believed that we were the superior race. We were here first, and this is our country.
Being part of that movement, I got to feel a sense of power when I felt powerless. I got attention when I felt invisible and accepted when I felt unlovable.
So Life After Hate is an organization that was founded by four ex-skinhead, neo-Nazi, white supremacists in the US and Canada. And they found each other, and they knew that they wanted to help other guys get out.
There's two parts to getting out of a violent extremist group. The first part is disengagement, which is where you leave the social group. And then the next part is de-radicalization, where the belief systems and the ideology are removed.
It was very impactful when someone finally came along with no fear, no judgment. He heard my story, did nothing to challenge it, but validated it.
Balkan conflict's been simmering for some time.
Kosovo je znači južna srpska pokrajina koja je trenutno okupirana od strane NATO.
The Albanians demanded the Kosovo Serbs change car license plates. In other words, they'd recognize Kosovo.
Ideš iz svoje države u svoju državu i lepiš simbol svoje države.
Belgrade refused. Kosovo is Serbia, so discriminating against Serbs there is a slap in the face.
Jednostavno, to nije poniženje nas, Srba koji živimo ovde, to je poniženje pre svega vlasti u Beogradu.
Posle rata 1999. godine, mi smo bili dužni da Albancima damo najširi oblik autonomije, a ne državu.
Serbian president Aleksandar Vučić hasn't ruled out the possibility that the West is waiting for the right moment to strike the Republic.
Doveli su nas do ivice, saterali su nas u ćošak. A kad je tako, onda ćemo čuvati i braniti naš narod.
Welcome back. You are watching The 360 View, and I'm Scottie Neal Hughes. You know, it's no secret the American economy is struggling. Biden is looking to end Trump-era tariffs to curb inflation, but it may have the opposite effect. Now, farmers are struggling to compete and throwing in the towel, while America is making it easier for companies to choose importing our food. We are becoming less and less food independent, while China quietly buys up all of our farmland. So to discuss if it's time for America to put herself first, we go to this report.
Scotty, inflation is impacting the entire world, but farmers are heavily burdened with the rising prices to keep food on our tables.
That inflationary spiral is especially harmful to you.
I spoke with Edward Morse, who is not only a professor of business law, but also an American farmer.
I think there's a natural benefit behind American agriculture that consumers ought to be thoughtful about.
Morse raises cattle and sells beef, as well as grows corn for feed. I asked Morse how record high inflation is impacting him on his farm.
We're large consumers of energy, so diesel fuel prices have more than doubled, and that affects our farming operation itself, the fuel that we need to run our tractors and equipment, but it also affects the transportation costs, moving our products to market and receiving inputs like fertilizers, feed, et cetera. All those things are affected by the higher fuel costs, and to some extent by the higher labor costs that this inflationary cycle is producing.
Another huge problem for American farmers, staying competitive. Not against each other, obviously, but more and more grocery stores and distributors are getting products, fruits, vegetables, even beef from Canada and South America. I ask, how is it possible to get blueberries cheaper by importing them?
There's this thing called a comparative advantage. Probably you have cheaper labor costs associated with picking the blueberries in that environment. But it is a little paradoxical, particularly when we think about the cost of the fuel to move those blueberries across the globe versus moving them, you know, from Michigan or somewhere of that nature. Of course, it's a good thing that we're able to import those berries from other parts of the world, because that means we can have berries year round and not just during berry season.
As Biden plans to revoke more Trump-era tariffs in the name of curbing inflation, it could get harder for the American farmer to stay competitive. But it's not just farmers in the United States suffering from a globalist economy. In the Netherlands, the government is instilling strict regulations on farmers to help curb their emissions output. New regulations require farmers to use less and less fertilizer and regulate their number of livestock. Farmers are protesting by blocking roadways for fear this strict implementation could lead them to shut down their farms and lose their livelihood. You can see in this video police opening fire on a Dutch farmer in a tractor.
Nee, hey, wapens, jongen, wapens. Hey, holla, rij weg, jongen, rij weg. Wapens is dat.
Shelves are bare across the Netherlands as farmers have halted the food supply chain in protest. In fact, countries across the world, Poland, Germany, Italy, and more are joining in, gathering in city centers, not only in support of the Netherlands, but also to protest against their own government's regulation. President Biden has run on a platform promising to cut carbon emissions and push the Green New Deal. I ask Morse, what can the United States government do to help farmers so the U.S. doesn't get to the point where we are putting global initiatives above our own ability to keep farmers in business?
My reaction to that would be do a lot less than they're doing right now, because I think the market forces are here to do to cause us to do the right things. And in fact, you know, the government intervention is a big reason that we're having the inflationary cycles that we have right now. Money supply over the past two years or so has grown by almost 50%, and we doubled over the past 15 years before that. So monetary policy and high government spending has put a lot of money chasing too few goods. Milton Friedman said inflation is always and everywhere a monetary problem, right? It's caused by things like expanding the money supply and expanding government spending. We had a $4 trillion deficit last time. Yeah, it's coming down maybe, but it's still a very large percentage of our GDP. So all of that spending combined with other government policies, like our energy policies, are absolutely devastating to farmers, consumers, all kinds of business people, to the extent we're driving up the costs of basic goods that we need, like diesel fuel and gasoline. We're driving the cost of natural gas. It's practically tripled from where it was. And keep in mind, natural gas is not just used for heating, but it's also a feedstock that's used for fertilizer manufacturing. So we saw, you know, a huge spike in fertilizer costs last spring. Some of that has subsided now, but we're past the primary window for fertilizer application. And so it's just demand driven. Demand's falling for fertilizer because we're in the midst of the growing season. And if your fertilizer is not down, it's probably not going down. And so honestly, government is a big part of the problem, and it's caused by bad government policies. And to the extent that government can do less interference, and allow the diffused wisdom of the marketplace to do its magic, that spontaneous order that arises from individuals making choices that are designed to maximize their well-being, that will produce a lot more goods and services in the marketplace, and it'll produce them faster, cheaper, and better compared with a lot of government interference. You know, and some of these policies are just absolutely destructive, especially the Biden administration's policies about fossil fuels and petroleum products, but it spills over into other areas. Emphasis on things like ESG policies or pressuring banks about lending to petroleum producers. Either of those things are all examples of interference that is destructive and harmful to consumers. And consumers ought to be aware of this because they might seem like something they want to support, but the downstream effects are going to be detrimental.
In India, the people came together to protest these green revolution laws put in place during coronavirus and now have become self-reliant. Will this benefit America to become more self-sufficient in the food they produce and provide for the country?
I think there are a lot of benefits toward trade. I noticed India, one of their responses to the war in the Ukraine has been to shut off exports. Argentina has done that because they're large, in the past, they've done that because they're large beef consumers. Their per capita beef consumption is way higher than any other country. And so if beef prices get high as a political matter, they shut off exports in order to satisfy the domestic demand more cheaply. I think that's a very costly way to go about rationing goods. You're interfering with that price signal that's very important.
Learn where your food comes from, the hard work put into produce the food on your own table, and buy local when you can. For 360 View, I'm Roxana Solano.
So when did it become wrong for a country to be economically independent? And why would it be the agenda of an administration to make policies and decisions which weakened their economy and the ability for the people to be self-reliant? It should never be the purpose of any government to create an economy which enslaves the people to the government. And yet in modern day society, it seems to be the goal as welfare and entitlements are at their peak. A country's welfare system should act as a temporary safety net, not a permanent hammock. And working hard and seeing the results of your work not only brings a sense of accomplishment, but a sense of pride. When you are invested in something, you are more likely to take care of it because it is something you know was not just given to you. You worked for it, and therefore you will work hard to not lose it. Now, every country should try to promote a feeling of economic nationalism at the very least with the hopes of becoming self-sustainable. And for those goods which are not feasible or don't make sense to produce, then relationships should be formed which are mutually beneficial. No country, just like no man, should ever strive to be overly reliant on another, for that is also a relinquishing of power. And no power for a country will always result in no peace for her people. Thank you for joining me on our two-part series on nationalism. Until next time, I'm Scottie Nell Hughes with your 360 View.